In early November 2006, Kirk W. Johnson, who had served in Baghdad and Fallujah with USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, received an email from a former Iraqi co-worker that read, "People are trying to kill me, and I need your help." That desperate message inspired Mr. Johnson to found the List Project, which has helped more than 1,500 Iraqis whose work with the United States government has caused them to fear for their lives to find refuge in the United States. In his book, To Be a Friend is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind, Mr. Johnson writes about his own experiences working in Iraq and what has happened since the military withdrawal to the people who cooperated with the Allies. It's published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it brings Kirk W. Johnson to our show today. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well. When you first went to Iraq in 2005, you were the only Arabic-speaking American employee in the U.S. Agency for International Development?
Yeah, I was the only one that had I had spent most of my life until that point living in the Middle East and studying Arabic. And I had been opposed to the war, but I wanted to try to help on the reconstruction, which I supported. And because I spoke Arabic when I got there, that's what led me to become very close friends with the Iraqis who were risking their lives to get into the green zone every day to help us.
There are many Americans who can speak Arabic. Why were none of them working for an agency like USAID?
Well, you know, at the time, you got to remember there weren't that many. I remember one article shortly after 9/11 that said that there was something like 100 Arabic studies graduates at the time of the attacks or something across our campuses. Obviously,
but there are Arab immigrants in the United States.
Yeah, of course. But you know, I think what you ask points to a much broader and much more familiar problem of a lack of planning. We didn't really go in anticipating all of the demands that we would need, and so when we got into Iraq, we found ourselves going through villages and cities and not being able to understand a word. And so a lot of Iraqis, thousands of them, stepped forward to sort of bridge that linguistic gap.
Well, how much did the agency know about the culture and customs of Iraq before it started sending people to Baghdad and Fallujah?
I mean, you know, it's difficult to make an assessment like that. I think if you could make any kind of generalization, it was that our programs in Iraq were more about what we thought Iraq ought to be than sort of derived from a close understanding or assessment of what Iraqis actually needed or wanted.
Were Iraqis suspicious of you, an American who spoke Arabic with an Egyptian accent?
If they were, they didn't. The ones that were working alongside me, they were friends of mine. Of course, when I took the job in Fallujah, where I was coordinating our aid efforts there, people, the Fallujans who we were meeting at the city council, you know, I think they probably thought I was an oddity, but it's hard to know.
Well, you say that you were studying Arabic. You did it on your own, and that's, you say it's because you took a trip to Egypt with your grandmother, and that inspired you to learn the language?
Yeah, it's a kind of unlikely story, but I had this amazing grandmother who she took all of her grandchildren to a different country in the world, and she took me to Egypt when I was 15. And until that point, my only dream in life was to play in the NBA, but I was short and pudgy and slow. And so when I got back from Cairo, I dove into Arabic studies while I was still in high school, and that's sort of what led to this prolonged engagement with the Middle East.
Do you ever wonder what would have happened if she had taken you to Outer Mongolia?
Yeah, I do, actually. I might have had maybe an easier life.
Didn't you take a test to work as a translator for the State Department?
I was doing a Fulbright in Egypt, and after that I did apply to work for the State Department, but they didn't take me.
Why not, if you spoke Arabic?
I think back in the day, and I don't, to be honest, don't know if much has changed, but they told me that the Arabic wasn't much of a relevant factor, that they're worried about their Foreign Service officers getting what they call localitis, so that even if I joined the Foreign Service, it was likely that they would have put me in Russia or Senegal or something. But I think what you might be referring to from the book was I was offered a job from the National Security Agency, of all people, to be an Arabic linguist with them, but I turned that job down too.
Because you didn't want to work for that agency?
No. I mean, I didn't study the language to sit in some dark basement booth and listening in on intercepts. I did it to try to do some good in the world.
So 2 years after the invasion, you wound up headed to Iraq to work for USAID. And you said you did it because you wanted to help people. What did you hope to accomplish there? And what is the mission of USAID in Iraq?
Well, USAID had...
It can be pronounced either way, can't it? USAID or USAID?
Yeah. You know, in fact, I alternate myself, and I'm a former USAID employee. So they had roughly $7 billion in reconstruction funds. Everything from trying to get the power turned back on to water coming out of the pipes to rebuilding schools and healthcare clinics. To jumpstarting the economy. I went over to try to help with that. I wasn't a soldier. I was a civilian. There are many points in the book where I kind of sort of map out the low points in my naivete, but I had no clue how just in over our heads we were with the Reconstruction Program and how sort of persistent the mistakes and repetitive the mistakes were, and they continued into Afghanistan as well.
My guest is Kirk W. Johnson. His book, To Be a Friend, is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind. It's published by Scribner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You describe a number of wasteful projects. Can you tell us about the MOAG project?
MOAG is that's one of my favorite stories from the war that I don't think many people know about, but MOAG stands for the Mother of All Generators. And in 2003, we bought a massive 700-ton generator for about $50 million to ideally install in a power plant in Kirkuk in north of Iraq. When we bought the generator, though, it was in Syria, in the port there, and we needed to move it across country, but we had just imposed sanctions on Syria, and so the Syrians wouldn't let us bring this huge generator over a bridge. They wouldn't share the load-bearing stats. And so we had to reroute the thing, which added months of time because it could only be transported at 5 miles per hour. What I write about in this sort of brief section of the book is what ended up happening. It sat for years at the Jordan-Iraq border where we were paying about $20,000, I think, a day in private security costs. And in the end, years after schedule and tens of millions of dollars over budget, we finally installed this generator in the power plant. And in all that time, nobody had bothered to train the Iraqis in how to operate and maintain the state-of-the-art generator. And so within a few months, it was broken. And to me, the reason why I bring that up is a couple reasons. One, the lack of electricity was the defining metric by which the Iraqis came to believe or disbelieve or trust the Americans. I mean, that we could talk all we wanted about how things were getting better, but they were only getting a couple hours of power a day. But secondly, for that amount of money, we could have bought scores of much smaller generators to just bring in on the back of semi-trucks in a matter of weeks. But that's a much less favorable sort of photo opportunity for a ribbon-cutting ceremony. And so, you know, the MOAG is sort of a symbol of good intentions horribly implemented and at great cost to both the United States and to the people of Iraq.
Was that a unique situation?
No. No, goodness, no. I mean, you can pick the sector of the reconstruction, and I can go on for hours with different stories like this.
What was your job with USAID or USAID when you first arrived in Iraq?
I was 24 when I got over there, and I was willing to take any position they gave me. So I was a lowly public affairs and information officer. And so my job when I got there was to basically learn as much as I could about the thousands of USAID projects throughout the country, and to produce what's known as the Iraq Daily Update, which was this sort of silly little one- or two-page briefer that would go out to a distribution list of tens of thousands of journalists and policymakers and others to try to kind of paint a nice picture of how the reconstruction was going. I got pretty tired of that pretty quickly because I realized I hadn't gone over to Iraq to sort of help sell some foundering reconstruction program. I wanted to actually do something. And so,
well, how did your boss respond when you told him that you were having a hard time getting positive stories to write about in the IDU?
Well, this is fairly Orwellian, and there are a lot of Orwellian streaks in this book, but they just, when I told them one day I was coming, I'd come back empty and I didn't have any good news to share, they just told me to go back into the archives a few months and find one of the old stories and just put it back out there again because nobody remembered. And it's true that, we have a very short attention span. So a lot of the updates were sort of recycled pablum.
And did you ever get any responses about the articles that you wrote?
I mean, these were like little email updates. And so, yeah, every time I sent them out, I would get, replies from neoconservatives back in Washington saying, thanks for the good news. I wonder why the media doesn't ever cover this. But I don't think they realized just how sort of inconsequential the vast majority of these programs were.
USAID was located in Baghdad's Green Zone. What was life like inside the Green Zone compared to the rest of the city?
There's a lot of people that have talked about this. I will say that it is, having lived in Damascus and Cairo and been all throughout the Middle East, it's, when you're living in the Green Zone, you're not really living in the Middle East. It's just this bizarre playground that's rimmed by blast walls and is filled with, American fast food joints and, parties every other night and, three-on-three basketball tournaments on the basketball court behind Saddam's palace and, talk like a pirate day and all of this sort of taken together, I think, led a lot of the civilians in Iraq and the policymakers to lose sight of what was happening outside of the blast walls.
You say it was kind of like returning to high school. Was it only Americans who were living there?
No, there were contractors and sort of mercenaries from all over the world. The Green Zone is also where most of the other embassies were housed as well. But it's mostly Westerners that were living there.
And how safe was it? You had to wear body armor when you walked between buildings, didn't you?
I mean, at high points of the conflict, when there was a lot of indirect fire coming in, they issued advisories, but it's a little bit difficult having lived in both Baghdad and Fallujah to really describe the Green Zone as a particularly dangerous place. I mean, mortars come in, most of them didn't explode, but compared to what the Iraqi people were living through and what Marines and soldiers on the front lines were, I mean, it was not a dangerous place.
Still, there was some danger, and you were given body armor. But Iraqi employees who were working in the Green Zone weren't issued body armor?
No, and that was one of the earliest signs to me that something was terribly wrong about the way that the Iraqis who worked for America were being valued. I got there in the first weeks of January 05 when the elections, the first elections were scheduled, and there were a lot of mortars and things coming in, and they issued this directive that we were to wear our helmets and body armor at all time. But the first morning when I walked out to go to the office, I was walking past all of my Iraqi colleagues who weren't wearing anything, and they weren't assigned any. They didn't have any, and that really bothered me because...
Were they aware?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I asked them where their armor was, they kind of just smirked and as if it was silly of me to ask this question. And when I asked the security people in the compound, they kind of snapped at me for not realizing how expensive body armor is. But I can't describe how kind of embarrassing and shameful it feels to be trundling in all of this body armor past your Iraqi colleagues as if, you know, a bullet is going to hit them differently than it would us, or that they're not made of the same flesh. And unfortunately, those kinds of attitudes, the one that led to a lack of body armor, you know, that really hasn't changed. I mean, we don't give these Iraqis very much protection at all, and it's been a very depressing battle over the last 7 years to try to get the government to value these people. But in exchange for risking their lives for us, they're basically given a thanks and not much else.
Kirk W. Johnson's writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal. He's the founder of the List Project to resettle Iraqi allies. And his book is To Be a Friend is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind. It's published by Scribner. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Kirk W. Johnson. His book, To Be a Friend is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind. It's published by Scribner. So after you worked at the Green Zone, you told your supervisor that you want to be transferred out into the field. Where did they send you?
I didn't realize that they would send me to Fallujah when I asked that question, but I'm very glad that they did. I was sent out as USAID's first coordinator to rebuild that city, and so I was in charge of about $25 million worth of aid efforts in the city.
Now, was Fallujah a lot more dangerous than Baghdad?
Without question. When I got there, of course, the city had already been, quote-unquote, pacified in late 2004, and I got there in late 05. You know, I was living with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force, and you know, there weren't that many days that went by where there weren't car bombs or IEDs or small skirmishes. Fortunately, I was spared most of that, but it was unlike anything I'd seen before, because in the Green Zone, you have to understand, a lot of times civilians will go to Iraq for a full year, and all they will know are the blast walls of the Green Zone. It's too costly and dangerous for civilians to go out to see projects, for example. But I was hitching rides on Marine convoys to go into the city several days a week, and so it was a wildly different experience.
Well, one of the big projects that USAID was funding in Fallujah was a rubble clearing program. How much money had been set aside for that, and how much work was being done?
Oh, this is another one of these sort of aid work from afar type projects that was already underway when I got there. Millions and millions of dollars had been given to a contractor to clear away rubble. This was the idea that it started with this premise that the reason why Iraqis were fighting us was because they were just frustrated by the lack of work. And so if we gave them an honest choice between killing us and a day's labor, they would pick the latter. And so it's already a deeply flawed assumption, but what flowed from that then was that we would funnel tens of millions of dollars to hire thousands of locals to pick up rubble at the rate of about $6 or $7 a day.
And you compare that to what they could get working for the insurgents.
Right. I mean, this is where a rift started to open between between me and the Green Zone, in that, you know, I mentioned to them that if you were a Fallujah kid, the going rates for laying an IED, a roadside bomb, you get paid about $75 by a militia. If you stood on a rooftop to spot for convoys, American convoys coming in, they'd give you about $125. And if you detonated the bomb with a phone or a push-button device, they'd pay you something like $150. There was no way that we could compete with those market forces, so to speak. But the more kind of, you know, egregious thing about the rubble removal program was that it just didn't exist. I mean, I was going through Fallujah every day. I was asking Marines who were snaking up and down every stretch of the city. Nobody actually saw any of these fields of rubble being cleared. It was just given to an American contractor who kept a chunk of it and gave a big chunk to a subcontractor and then sent reports back to the Green Zone about how great things were going.
Did you see a lot of corruption of this sort in Iraq?
Well, you know, it's a weird... Yeah, I mean, the corruption has been well documented, but it's sort of this soup of corruption and incompetence, poorly thought-out programs, and a lack of oversight. And so, you know, as I was the first person that went out to Fallujah where we were ostensibly spending all this money, but I couldn't see proof of it anywhere. And so, you know, I was really fighting to shift the remaining funds to a project that I thought might actually work and might actually have an impact, which was clearing the irrigation canals, because the fields had all, been suffering because the canals were all choked up after years of growth. And I was pushing hard for this project. I was just about to get it launched, and then I took what was supposed to just be like a 5-day or 6-day vacation to the Caribbean to be with family. And I write about this in the book, but I never went back to Fallujah after that.
Well, before we go on that vacation and look at the awful events that occurred during that vacation, just a little more time in Fallujah. We were talking about the fact that we paid so much less than the insurgents, and you write that your supervisors would often call Iraqis Muhammad instead of learning their real names. Iraqi employees had to submit to a polygraph and bomb residue tests, while other employees did not. Did we realize that we were insulting them in these ways?
You know, that's a question that I wrestle with a lot. I don't think there's any way that an honest assessment could result in any other conclusion, that we were treating these people as expendable third-class citizens. And so the number three official at USAID in Baghdad, she used to give briefings to newly arrived aid workers, and one of them asked once, you know, there's so many Iraqis working for us. Like, do you have a list of their names, and how do we kind of master their names? And she kind of just laughed and said, oh, just call them Ahmed or Mohammed. That seems to do the trick. These were, I think we sort of insulated ourselves from the horrors of what was happening out in the red zone in the rest of Iraq, and we came to view these people who were trying to sneak into the Green Zone every day past snipers and militiamen and other insurgents who were, you know, poised there to try to hunt and kill these people. They were trying to come in to help us, and then we treated them this way, which is, it's still rankles me after all these years.
How did the U.S. government respond when its Iraqi employees told them that they were getting death threats, that they had to kind of act like spies in order to go to and from work each day, and that they had to pass through what was called the Assassin's Gate?
Their response was very simple. We can't really do anything for you. I mean, you know, I think, you know, the Iraqis were asking for certain things like badges that would get them the ability to drive into the green zone, which would give them a little bit more security, but that was denied. It was one big brush off. And, you know, I recall, and I still get this from government officials, this line of argument that, hey, these Iraqis get paid a lot more to come work for us than they would anywhere else in Iraq. They, you know, they're amply compensated for that risk. But the average annual salary that we paid these Iraqis was something like $10,000. So it's the cost of our clean conscience is pretty cheap, I would say.
My guest is Kirk W. Johnson. His book, To Be a Friend is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind. Okay, let's get to that vacation where you suffered from a PTSD-induced thing called dissociative fugue state. Was that a result of what had happened to you in Fallujah?
You know, I think it was just a result of a pretty draining and, tiring year. I didn't feel that I had PTSD. I didn't, you know, I felt energized and in shape and very engaged with my work. But, my first night, I was in the Dominican Republic with family. And my first night there, I remember everything perfectly. I went to sleep. And the next thing I know, I was standing in front of my hotel window, staring out at this unfinished building across the way. And it was the middle of the night, and I thought I was back in Fallujah and not wearing any body armor. And I quickly, you know, yelled out and crouched below the window because I thought I had just given a silhouette to a sniper to shoot. And in that first night, I woke up, I stored that memory, and I felt this sort of, you know, dissonance. I'd never been confused about where I was before. I was a little thrown off by it over the course of the following day. The next night, I wasn't as lucky. I didn't wake up. At about 4:30 in the morning, I crawled out onto a windowsill. I was apparently sitting out on a ledge when a guard at the resort was making his rounds and shown us a flashlight on me and tried to, you know, talk me back in. I don't think I was suicidal or anything. I can't claim to know what I was thinking because I have no memory of the experience. But as he was running around to the front of the hotel, I leapt out the back and landed on concrete, broke both my wrists, my jaw, broke my nose. I cracked my skull in two places and needed about 80 stitches to sew my face shut. And so that ended my year in Iraq.
Well, Kirk, we have very little time, and we still have a lot of story to tell, so I'm going to try to rush us through this because this is really important. While you were healing, you received a message from a former coworker named Yagdan, which said that he had received death threats as a result of his identity being discovered by militiamen. And what happened? Did you speak to the government, try to get him, gain him asylum in this country?
Yes. Basically, what that email kind of woke me up from this year of depression and made me realize I could stop worrying about myself and help somebody else. And so for the last 7 years, I've been fighting the cases of Iraqis like Yagdan and thousands of others who worked for us through our organization, the List Project.
Has it been a real struggle? I'm sorry to interrupt because I want to hit this one other thing. You published an op-ed piece in the L.A. Times on December 15, 2006, titled Safeguarding Our Allies. And the Bush State Department said that your contract with them didn't allow you to publish anything about your time in Iraq?
Yeah, they discouraged me from publishing anything without their approval. This is in USAID, but I've ignored that discouragement. No, this was both, you know, quite honestly, both the Bush and Obama administrations have been opposed to resettling these people. It has been an immense struggle. There have been high points and low points, and regrettably, I think we're coming up on another low point here, because this piece of legislation that Senator Kennedy passed 5 years ago, which opened up 25,000 visa slots to protect these Iraqis, that's going to expire in about 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, and there are still about 15,000 visas that were never used due to State Department incompetence.
And, Kirk, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. I assume that the same thing applies to people from Afghanistan. Kirk W. Johnson's book, To Be a Friend is Fatal, The Fight to Save the Iraqis America Left Behind, is published by Scrivener. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you for having me.